So, hello everyone. I just wanted to welcome you. My name's Mim and I run a project at the university called Agile Ox. And the aim of that project is to try and make university research with an environmental focus more useful in Oxfordshire and make it interesting and reach out to different audiences. So I do that through events like this, and the hope is that I create new partnerships, new research collaboration, and also be part of the process of using priorities for Oxfordshire, getting them into the university in terms of research focus. So this is one of four events I'm doing this week. So if you want more after this, tomorrow night there is a film at the Ultimate Picture Palace, which will come along with it's a beautiful film called Watermark. It's really stunning, about how we shape water and water shapes us around the world. And it's going to be complete with a sort of mini showcase of water research and some chances to get involved in research, which is coming up. And then we're going to go for a swim afterwards in the Thames. Bathers optional. And then on Thursday nights, I'm going to be back here, and that's kind of the old title for it, unfortunately. I did get really excited about a neighbours kind of theme to it, but other people didn't. So it's about community energy and what you can do in your communities to help reduce peak demand and therefore our reliance on coal and things like that. Just a couple of other things that are happening this week. I have a competition which was meant to be in the Oxford Mail, didn't quite get printed, so I printed it myself, and it's here, and it ends tomorrow at 5, and you can win tickets to Tandem Festival, which is on Saturday this week, and a hamper of Cultivate produce, local produce. And all you have to do is figure out what's happening in two of these images and email me on that email address. So it's not too challenging. There are leaflets about it here, and there's leaflets about the events here as well. And the last thing I'll tell you about is I'm also, on behalf of Low Carbon Oxford, giving people the chance to sign up to pledge. And these are the four pledges that you can make. You can choose any one of them, or pledge lots if you want. And you get a very exciting bag and the chance to win £100 of MS stuff, which is exciting. So tonight's event, it's in aid of Asylum Welcome, and we've raised, I'd say, about £230 probably for Asylum Welcome, and introducing Danny. So he's from the School of Geography and the Environment. He's been in Oxford for 3 years. He did grow up in Oxford, but then he went to Newcastle to seek his fortune. And he said that and growing up in Oxford back then made me think inequality mattered. And he said some other things too, which I'm sure he will tell you about. So the key question that I'm really looking forward to, that I know he will bring up at some point, is what can we do in Oxford and Oxfordshire, as well as agitating for a better country and a better world? So Danny, it's over to you.
Thank you very much. Thanks so much. I do remember as a 17-year-old in Oxford back in 1985, thinking if these undergraduates ever get power, we're really going to be in trouble. I should explain the title. Mim asked if we could do a talk as part of this week of Green Events. And I said, fine, if we do a normal talk and we do it for free, we'll end up giving out lots of tickets and not being sure who's going to turn up. So we need to use the market mechanism to actually try and get the right numbers in the room. And I'm very smug because you close the tickets today in the afternoon and we've got exactly the right numbers of people in the room. And money has helped do that because you've all paid and we're very grateful you've paid, and to Asylum Welcome, we're very grateful you paid. We originally thought of charging £1 and then just giving you your £1 back if you turned up. That sounds simple, but it's actually slightly more complicated because you've made a profit, should you record it anywhere? What happens if the money goes missing? Those kind of things. So it's an example of using the market to make something actually work fairly efficiently in terms of filling a room with the right number of people, but not making a profit from it. The second thing I need to confess is this very long title. I'm not actually going to talk exactly to this title. The title was designed to try and get the right people in the room. We'll find out in the next hour if this has worked. Plenty of time for questions, don't worry. And if you get really irate, interrupt me. Because the worst possible question you can get at the end of a talk like this is, that was all rubbish, I don't know where to start. So hopefully there'll be things that, but if you see something and you think that's very odd, I'm happy to be interrupted. So the title's designed to get together a group of people who might find these ideas interesting. The cop-out answer to how to manipulate markets to get better results is to go and buy Robert Frank's new book. It's in Black Wells, it's called Success and Chance. Robert Frank is, I think, the most successful academic economist in the United States and the rest of the world. He wrote the main economic textbook that is used in American colleges with a man called Ben Bernanke. And it sells very well. It sells so well that Robert Frank has direct experience of bidding for the best marina place for his yacht where he lives. Robert Frank hence understands the rich quite well because he is rich. And what Success and Chance does, I'm going to try and sell this book to you often, and mine, is it explains directly to America's rich why it's in their interest to behave better, why being taxed highly doesn't actually damage them, because it simply reduces the cost of a place in the marina for your yacht, it reduces the cost of the houses that the rich are competing to buy, and it has a whole set of ideas in it. But the interesting thing to me about this, and I've got lots of pictures and slides to show you in a minute, it's that mainstream economists are now beginning to say the way we have been doing things is very wrong. Common understanding of economics, particularly since 2008, is very wrong. And it isn't just mavericks and weirdos like me who are saying it anymore. It's becoming much more commonplace. Let's see if we can go forward. Okay. This is the donation bin in Whitney in Waitrose for the food bank. A friend of mine took this last month and the bin's looking pretty empty. Things can go very wrong in a society. I don't think anybody would believe me if I'd been standing here 10 years ago and I'd have said we'd have bins for collecting food in Whitney in West Oxfordshire because there are food banks. We have lots and lots of problems in our society at the moment, and this is changing how people think. Now the main thing, what I want to talk about, is the environment and how you can get people to behave in better ways environmentally and what stops them from doing that. But it is connected to all these other issues. Okay, graphs. I'm afraid the bad news for you is that I like graphs. So there'll be quite a lot of these graphs. These are not published anywhere. So I'm thinking of putting these in a book this year that will be published next year. I first drew graphs like this about 5 years ago using data from then. I've updated it using more recent data. And they're graphs about a series of correlations. Now, correlations are only correlations, but they don't happen by chance. This isn't suggesting that one thing is causing another. But you can't get a series of coincidences as long as a series of coincidences that I'm going to show you purely by chance. Something is going on. I mean, that people behave very differently. In this case, we're looking at the 25 richest countries in the world with at least 2 million people. So I haven't selected, you know, I haven't taken some countries out because they don't fit. I'm including all the countries that are in the richest 25 with at least 2 million. And what I'm going to show you is various measures of behaviour and how it relates to income inequality. Now, the most unequal country in the rich world is the United States. In the United States, the best off 10th for the population, so people like me, if I was a university professor in the States, we'll be getting about 20 times more money per year in their household than the poorest tenth. That's extreme inequality. We, not far off there, we are an incredibly unequal country, along with Singapore, and I think that dot might have been Portugal. The most equal country, at least until a couple of years ago, in the rich world was Japan. The size of the bubble is the population. To stop you spending too long looking at very small countries, we've made that the size proportional. And here you can see a fairly important relationship in terms of the environment. This is the amount of meat people eat a year. It's in kilograms per capita. So you're looking at around about 120 kilograms in the United States, you're looking at around about 80 in the United Kingdom, and you're looking at just over 45 in Japan. It doesn't include fish. Question people always ask, what's including fish? You might think that, oh, the Japanese diet has always been healthier. We don't know, because nobody actually measured it back in the 1920s and 30s particularly well. But in general, you'll see that in countries which are more equal, people are consuming less meat. Meat isn't particularly good for you. The amount of meat the average American eats isn't good for them. This isn't because the rich are eating lots of meat, because if the rich were eating, say, two or three times as much meat as the average, they'd be dying faster, because it's that bad, if you've seen the supersized movement. So what is going on? And I haven't got a complete answer to it. But if you look at things like advertising, you'll find that in the United States they spend about 4% of their GDP on advertising. Here in the UK it's about 2%, in mainland Europe it's 1%, in Japan it's even less. So there are enormous differences between societies in how much money people spend to try to get people to buy things that they do not need. That's what advertising is about. It's, if you actually needed it and wanted it, you wouldn't need to advertise it. Advertising is largely about trying to get you to consume more of something that you wouldn't otherwise consume. And it isn't. And it isn't particularly good for the environment to get people to consume more than they actually need. On all these graphs, you'll see exceptions. And all the exceptions are always interesting, particularly if you're a geographer. As I said, I did these graphs about 5 years ago as well, and they move around because the data isn't necessarily brilliant. It should be fairly obvious to you why New Zealand eats more meat than you'd expect. There is an awful amount of meat to be eaten in New Zealand. This is relatively cheap. And Australia, I think this little dot is Denmark, and that's bacon. there are always exceptions, but that's my first graph. Water. Now this is only residential consumption of water. Most of our water consumption is industrial, and even more is agricultural. So if you're worrying about water use, I'm not an expert on water. My department in the university includes a ridiculous number of experts on water, so I try not to say too much about it. But again, you'll see a similar kind of slope. And it isn't because people in the United States are particularly clean and want to have more showers and more baths. The Japanese actually are ridiculously clean washing a lot. It's things like having a pool, having a swimming pool. And a swimming pool is a very strange object really to have privately. Apologies to anybody who happens to have a swimming pool. There are swimming pools in gardens in Oxford. But it really, having your own swimming pool, unless you are an avid swimmer who wants to get up every day and jump into the pool and go up and down repeatedly, isn't a very efficient way of getting people to swim. The sensible way to swim is to have publicly funded swimming pools. And if Oxfordshire wanted to become more green, we do something about the swimming pools. We make sure we have enough. If any of you got small children and try and take them swimming, you will know about queuing at Terry Pool and so on, and keeping Temple County Pool open. But in more unequal countries, you have worse provision of public pools, you have more private swimming pools. UK is low, I suspect, because there are good reasons why you don't have a swimming pool in the UK, even if you're quite rich, which is the number of days a year, until recently with a bit of global warming, the number of days a year in which you might use your swimming pool is up. But these are huge differences in behaviour over a good that costs quite a lot to produce. Waste is my favourite. I see waste as being largely consumption. Almost everything you buy, apart from jewellery, which you'll tend to keep, and food, which goes through another way, almost everything you buy goes into that bin that's emptied every 2 weeks. So if we just weigh the amount of waste, we get an idea of how much you've bought. And the United States, people are buying every week twice as much in weight as they buy in Japan. Now the suggestion here is something is going on related to inequality, which isn't perfect, I'll talk about that in a minute, but something is going on where in more unequal countries and in more unequal cities like Oxford, people buy more than they would buy, say, in our twin city in Bonn in Germany, certainly than they buy more in somewhere like Bern in Switzerland. And the question is, why do they buy more? They don't buy more to have more, because this stuff is all going in the bin. Almost everything you buy goes in the bin until you get the madness of storage boxes. I went to a poll of who currently has something in one of those great big storage boxes that they're paying rent on. And of course they are higher in more unequal countries. The United States had them first, then it came to the UK. This is people buying things that they are not using, and we know they're not using because they've thrown it away. So the question is, who's convinced them to buy it? And why did you feel the need to, say, buy clothes at twice the rate that people buy clothes in other countries? In more economically equal countries, the quality of clothing tends to be higher. It's often black, but that's a separate thing, if you think about the Mediterranean. People buy it less often, it lasts longer. We're in a country where if you go to a shopping mall, you find the majority of shops in the shopping mall, the clothes shops. Philip Green has done very well out of this, and the idea is manufacture it very cheap, get it here, help sponsor the fashion industry, and please get people to feel the need to continuously buy more clothes, particularly young adults, and throw them away because they simply cannot store the amount of clothes they buy. And it varies. Denmark and Switzerland, my worry about them is I think they've just got very, very good at measuring every bit of waste that's thrown away. And they are not particularly profitable because the waste is improved. And you said at the beginning about encouraging people to work together. If anybody is particularly interested in this, all these issues need somebody to look at them carefully and actually work out what the international numbers are. It is not easy. It can get very, very boring. Very quickly, but it needs to be done because these are fairly important things. CO2 emission estimates. Now, for obvious reasons, the United States has cars, and this will matter in the next few slides I show you. Australia, countries which have a sparser population, will have more emissions, but Australia chose to have a sparse population. Australia has a system of housing where you get half acre or acre plots, and you soon end up, I think it's now 30 miles outside the edge of Melbourne, because there's an English attitude that perfection is getting yourself a house with a garden that's detached. And it sounds great for the individual, but if everybody gets themselves a house which is with a garden which is detached, you end up with these enormous commutes to get into the middle of town. It's a bit like people complaining about the traffic when they're sitting in a car. When you are the traffic, the reason for the problem is the behaviour of people themselves. I think we're low because of the dash for gas, and that our power stations switched over to gas so much so recently, which is just the good fortune of having access to gas nearby, and is a temporary thing. But again, this general relationship. I don't think I've got the overall footprint one, so I'll tell you now. if everybody behaved like the average person in the United States and the world, you'd need four planets. If everybody behaved like the average citizen in Japan, which is the best behaved in the rich countries, you'd still need two. Because even in Japan, people are buying and wasting and polluting more than it's possible for the planet to sustain. But that gap between four times and two times is enormous. You can go to streets in Japan. Here we have a green bin, a blue bin, a brown bin. It's about the most bins you can fit in front of your house. In Japan, in some streets, they have up to 30 different coloured bins. And the bins are at the end of the street, because you only have the bins for an entire street. You don't have the stupidity of your individual bin. We're quite wedded to that at the moment. Our ecological footprint, there you go. Ecological footprint data has become commercial, so it's actually very hard to get hold of it, which does seem wrong to me somehow. But there's an attempt to show it. You can see the general relationship. And again, my worry about Denmark, Belgium and Sweden, I really don't think that these are terrible, terrible places. I just think they've got much better at measuring the behaviour of people because they're more worried about it. But we've drawn the dots small so that you don't get fixated on.
What have you got in there?
This is the New Economics Foundation's measure of the total ecological footprint of a person. So it's not just the CO2 emissions. It's the entire environmental damage that you do, all things included. I try to use other people's data because I can then blame them for the data. And you try to find the most equitable source. But it's got tricky with ecological footprint data recently. Because there's a kind of war going on between the various groups who are producing it. I mean, the key thing about the footprint, the clever footprints, include the pollution caused in China by the goods we brought here. And that then alters the equation. That measure did include that. Right, flying, not so much of a relationship. It was better a few years ago, but still not good. And again, Kate, Norway is practically an island. I know it isn't, but it might as well be, from the point of view of getting on and off Norway. And of course, New Zealand is an island, although they are trying to get Air New Zealand planes with chip fat as their main fuel. We've got one, doesn't really work. down here, we've got France and Germany, Spain and Italy. So why don't people fly so much in France and Germany? France and Spain, Germany and Italy, because they've got a train system that works. I was in Bern a few months ago in Switzerland. We were staying in an old age people's home. The old age people's home was built in the middle of the city, in a tower block. This is a city as beautiful as Oxford. Can you imagine building a tower block? We're on the 17th floor in the middle. So that the elderly, these were very elderly people, they were largely on sewer frames or wheelchairs, could actually enjoy the middle of the city. And from the 17th floor, you could look down on the train station. This is a city with a population smaller than Oxford, and see the 24 tracks of the main train station and how big it was compared to our train station. And if you're going anywhere in Europe, you'd just get on a train. And where do the trains park at night when there's so many trains? They all just stop where they are on the train station, because you couldn't possibly have a depot to park as many trains when you have that many trains, which is very different from our system. I've got a lot more slides to show you, so I'll speed up a little bit. There's a general argument about inequality, the problems of economic inequality. There's lots of evidence to say that trust reduces in more unequal countries. The standard kind of question is to ask people, if you were on the train, that's okay. Would you leave your bag with a stranger when you went to the toilet? And the proportion of people who say yes to that reduces as a country becomes more unequal. The answer is, it's always worth leaving your bag with a stranger. They hardly ever steal it. But you become more fearful in places where the gaps between you are so wide, because your lives are separated. You do not get on with people who are paid 10 times less than you. You might superficially get on, you might smile to them as they serve your food, but you really don't get on. And they really do spit in the food. And you really do sit in your committee at university and say, oh, well, I don't think we can pay the living wage this year. We're ever so poor. That kind of thing doesn't go on in a normal country. That kind of thing is the story of my life in the last 3 years. Understanding is less when you're this unequal. We learn less well and we compete in buying more. I'll show you some evidence of that in a minute. Exam results become really, really important. Exam results really matter in unequal countries because if you do badly at school, you're going to end up down at the bottom and not up at the top, and the gap between the two is too big. So we become so obsessed with exam results, we don't actually worry too much about teaching children. I'm going to show you maths, but we get the same for literacy and problem solving as I'll show you for maths. And so here's the graph for maths. This is age 15. The data comes from 2012. It's a piece of data, average maths ability of 15-year-olds. And you see relatively high in Japan, slightly ridiculous in Singapore. In China, it's even more ridiculous, but I'm only looking at the 25 richest countries in the world. Here in China, of course, it's ridiculous because most Chinese children are not included, if you know about stats. Greece wasn't doing too well, but the US really bad, and the UK pretty bad. Now this looks as the kind of graph I've been waving at the last few graphs. They're not particularly tight. What's fascinating, or what a sad person like me who likes graphs gets very excited about, is when you don't look at maths ability at age 15, but you look at it a few years later, up to age 24. And then everything lines up. It'll be partly chance it's lined up so well. But it's not just chance. What happens is that we teach our children to get an A at GCSE or get a C if they're going to get an E or a D, and the school teachers are rewarded for that or sacked if they fail, and the schools are graded by that. So we work very hard for children in maths to get a particular letter in such a way that most children hate maths. Most students I teach in geography don't particularly like maths, otherwise they wouldn't go on geography. In other countries, in most rich countries, which are normal, unlike us, who are weird, we think we're normal, in most countries, somehow they're teaching their children maths in such a way that by age 24, they still can pass a maths test. Whereas we are teaching children maths in such a way that once you've got your A, you never have to really do maths again. It's not to enjoy it. And the fact that the US is there as well. So these nice young people outside, talking very loudly, unless they're doing maths or physics or probably chemistry, they'll almost certainly have an A star at GCSE maths. They may even have an A or even an A star at A level maths. But it was to get the A and A star to get them into Oxford. That was the point. Very few of them who actually got those A stars at GCSE and at A level got an intrinsic love for the subject because they're English, being pushed and pushed and pushed because competition's terribly important and you have to get the high grades. And that comes to the detriment of learning. Now this is for the average, this is for everybody. But I am absolutely certain that if you were to do a maths test for students aged 21 in Bonn, and students aged 21 in Oxford, and students aged 21 in Paris, you would find that our students don't perform particularly well, which might explain why our government has refused PISA to allow them to test our university students at these 100 things and to compare. I'm getting quite a way off the subject, I'll get back on it again. I'm going to talk to you about recent inequality trends, because these things get me excited, and then I will bring it to an end by talking about Oxford and Oxfordshire. So if you're thinking this is getting far too far away from being green and behaviour, we are going to get there towards the end. This is the worldwide distribution of income and how it's changed for the entire planet. So forget the richest 25 countries, this is all about the same number of bones in the human body. It's roughly 200 countries in the world. And it's a change since 1988 to 2008. The poorest people in the world I'm going to show you the update in a minute, but a few years ago, things hadn't got any better for them. Right? Not less well off, but not more well off. Then you've had this incredible increase in real income in the middle of the world income distribution. It's largely China. It's not fake. The world has become more equal. Most people in the second and third quintile in the world have seen big increases in their standards of living. Then you get down here. This is us. These are people who are better off than 85% of the rest of the people in the world, which means, in terms of Oxford, they live in Cowley. Or they live in Detroit. And you've actually had a slight fall in income because car jobs in Detroit and in Cowley pay twice as much as working in a shop, and the car jobs are gone. And this is the tiny group that we get fixated about, the very richest in the world. We've done quite well, but there aren't many of them. The problem is they're half the world's wealth. But it's a really interesting distribution of change that's occurred. And it's not all bad news. There's the second reference. I'm not going to give you any other book references, but this is Branko Milanovic's book on world income change, and just published. World Bank economist, mainstream. Things are changing really quickly since 2008. You're suddenly seeing what was very strange to argue in the year 2000, being argued by people who were absolutely at the centre of academia of societies. So he's talking about that general improvement in the middle. For real geeks, here's the updated graph. Same year, it's just better data. The world's very poorest have actually seen a 15% rise. That is from subsistence to subsistence, a little bit of a cash economy, but it's different. And not quite so bad for people at the bottom end of the richest countries, but a bit worse, I think, at the top. So all these things are still being worked out. Completely different data source. The last data source I'm going to show you, and this is a very new message from the message of the last 25 years. Something may have changed. How many people here, let's see if I've got the audience right by giving you the very weird title. How many people here have read the Spirit Level book? And how many have not read the Spirit Level book? Okay, still got to read it. The Spirit Level book was the best-selling social science book of the last decade, written by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, and it had lots of these kind of correlations, but for things like numbers of people in prison, violence, infant mortality rates, teenage pregnancies, obesity, really strong, I haven't mentioned obesity, really strong relationships with obesity. Because you eat more in more unequal countries, and also you drive more, which is a really good way to get fat, because if you want to avoid exercise, driving is the best way to do it. And that book showed this very strong relationship between many social harms and inequality. And the ratio it used was the ratio of the best off fifth in the country by a household and the worst off fifth in the country. And they used the UNDP measure. And the UNDP measure that came from around about 2004. UNDP, which is one of the, I think, the third biggest agency in the United Nations, United Nations Development Programme, got rid of their NICE director shortly after 2004. And appointed an American. And the American decided that they weren't going to produce any more inequality statistics, and they didn't. And then they got rid of the American and they appointed another NICE director. So we have inequality statistics again, the UNDP figures. And these are the latest inequality statistics. The most recent for 2013, but sometimes you have another survey, so they can be as old as 2005. So I'm comparing that number to that number. Let's take Austria, a fairly equitable country, the best off 10% by this measure, sorry, 20%, they're getting 4.6 times more than the worst off 20%. Shout now if you don't get it. Don't be embarrassed. You grew up in a country where we didn't do maths well. Right. The best off fifth, the population, on average, every year, have an income to their household that is 4.6 times higher than the poorest fifth of households. When Richard and Kate did their book, it was 4.7. So it's fallen by 0.1, which is a tenth of the income of the poorest households.
So is that before after tax?
let's get this right. This is after tax, but before housing costs and after transfers. So this includes all the benefit data, the money, pensions, everything else you get. It's really terrible if you don't include those. So it's actual disposable income, except you've got to pay for your housing. Now, again, we're looking at the richest 25, or I think it's 30 countries, defined by UNDP. These are the most equal. And the thing that gets me excited, because these numbers have been getting worse and worse for almost my entire life, is all the ones that are yellow have become more equal. So places like Sweden and Denmark, which are already very equal, are seeing income inequality fall. Now, people tell you in the UK and USA, it's all about the price of talent, and I'm afraid it's going to get more unequal and stuff you can do about it. But in all these countries, it's become more equal. Norway, Finland and Slovakia basically haven't moved. The Czech Republic's got a little bit worse. But they're the most equal 10. Here's the next set. All the rest of the richest countries according to the UNDP definition. They're not quite so good, in that more of them are becoming more unequal than equal, but still not the picture you're top. It is possible for countries to become more equal. They actually have done so recently. People in Germany know Germany's become more unequal. They complain about the part-time work. It's remarkable how well these numbers correlate to stories and popular discussion, particularly about the bad things. And one problem is that social scientists are very good at talking about bad things. We look for bad things, we study bad things. We don't look for happiness to go and find that. Partly because people won't fund us for finding good news stories. We kind of try and find what's the worst thing happening now, let's go and study it and complain about it. But in Germany it's got worse, Belgium's got worse, but France has got better. The same rate as Germany's got worse. Poland's got much better. That could be remittances going back into households for people who've gone out of Poland to work in Germany and in the UK. But Switzerland's got better. Ireland, remarkably, data might not be very recent, but it's got better. But it's very possible that what's happened in Ireland is similar to what's happened in Portugal, which might be by other data, or it's not in their list. Portugal inequality has fallen because the well-off have seen their house prices collapse in Portugal, and in Ireland house prices collapsed. The poorest fifth don't own houses, so house price collapse increases equality. I won't go through the rest of the list other than to say it's not surprising things have got worse in Spain. You've seen absolute immiseration in Spain. I think half of young under 25s out of work. The United Kingdom carries on getting a little bit more unequal. It's really hard for George Osborne to make us more unequal, but he works at it very, very hard and manages to achieve it. The US, even more, but I'm going to show you some other news in the US in a minute. And Israel, massive increase in inequality. These are strange countries, these ones, with these kind of inequality differentials and still getting worse. These two countries are really interesting. UNDP includes them in their riches list, and just look at what's happened in those. I won't go about that, just put it up for completeness. If you worry that the differences between people economically actually makes it very hard in an unequal country for people to behave in better ways environmentally, and then you think it's really hard to change inequality, the fact that inequality has changed in these countries should make you feel better about it. Thomas Piketty and the Economist in December produced a report about the pollution generated by the best of 0.1%, 1% and so on, and showed that so much of the CO2 emissions of a country like UK are actually caused by the very best of. So you've got to kind of use your brain. What might be the most carbon polluting thing within 10 miles of where I'm standing now? Maybe 12?
Airplanes.
It's Kiddington. And it's private airplanes because there are no private airplanes in that airport as far as I know. If you look around London, you see London is ringed by small private airports. Going up and down in your private jets, incredibly efficient. These are the poorest countries of the world. The data is really dodgy for these countries, but this is the United Nations best data. And in almost all of them, you've had dramatic falls in inequality. Now, very dodgy data, but if you have a tendency to be somebody who says the world's getting worse and worse and worse, something new since 2008 may have begun to happen.
Are you confident in your previous curve that the error bars are such that these 0.1s and 0.2s are actually are a difference?
Not the 0.1s and 0.2s, but the 0.3s and 0.4s I'm more confident about. What somebody could do, and this is the best place for somebody to do it because it's university, is get the EU SILP, which is the survey of incomes, and look very carefully for individual countries that change over time to see whether something strange happened to account for errors. So in the past, I think it was for Norway, there was a tax change and something 1% got much richer. But
I'll zoom on to more. I do worry about these things. I did a book a few years ago called The No Nonsense Guide to Equality, and it had this graph in it. And I'm just going to show you the update of this graph. This graph is the take of the 1% in 12 countries. The best off 1% used to take lots of money everywhere when we had Downton Abbey in this country. Everywhere in the world became dramatically more equal to the 1970s for various reasons. The cost of wars, the only way you can raise money to fight wars is taxing the rich. The Russian Revolution helped because it concentrated the minds of the rich because some of the rich got shot in Russia. And then we had an increase in inequality until recently, but a widening out. Some countries didn't do it. We were told that everywhere did it. This is the updated graph. This shows how very sad I am, because you won't have noticed the difference. But if you look at the very end, you'll see they're beginning to drop down. This is taking the 1%. The data's from the World Top Incomes Database, which is held in Paris, which is our best source, which Tony Atkinson from Nuffield College contributed to. And I could just take you through some of the stats and then what we need to worry about. And this really is dodgy, which is why nobody has talked about this publicly, because this data isn't particularly reliable. It comes from tax records. But the take has been rising and rising since I was born in the 1970s, particularly since the late 70s. But the USA may have hit a peak in 2012. Very, very slight, but I'll show you something else. The UK is really dodgy. Peak in 2009, and then a drop 2010 to 11. In fact, the biggest drop in the rich world in the take of 1%. The problem is the drop came at the point when Gordon Brown brought in the 50p tax rate. People in the 1% declared their tax a year early to avoid that, and they then set up company after company, his and hers. You can find them in Oxford, they're not mainly in the summer town. Normally trustees of the academy schools. So I'm not getting myself in any more trouble, but any academy school trustee has to declare their directorship of companies. Huge increase in companies with no employees. So that when you build your bike shed, it's a taxable expense and it isn't an income, the money you've got in. I think what's happened in the UK is almost totally explainable by increased corruption. Because of corporation tax coming down, and almost an encouragement to do it. My hope is that's not the reason elsewhere in the world. Canada 2009, Germany 2008, no data for India. Switzerland peaked 2008 and has been down since. Okay, France, that's very recent. Japan, not bad. Netherlands, we've got 2 years of lower data. Sweden's still going up, but very low. China, and of course people do worry about Chinese statistics, and the Chinese elite get their money out of China, to places like Oxford, where you buy yourself a house in the north. But that's a drop in the recorded income. I'm showing it you because what we have now doesn't look dissimilar to what happened at the last maxima. I'll just take you through a few of them. There's the United States. One drop, then another little drop. Obama has actually increased tax take in the United States. Obama's increased social spending. He did it so slowly and so little that he got no praise from the Democrats for doing it. He actually did do it. Canada, similar. And this is before Trudeau comes in. There's the UK standing out like a sore thumb. Yeah. that didn't really happen. But the 1% are now paying less tax than they were paying before because they declare that they've got less income. At the same time, the Sunday Times richness have actually doubled their wealth. But these things don't work. Much, much more important is to see how France went on a very different journey to the UK in terms of what the 1% take. Switzerland and the Netherlands, all have been quite slow, and again, the question is, are we beginning to see what we last saw around about 1913, really, in terms of fall? Finland and Sweden, for anybody fascinated in Scandinavia, are kind of converging on the 1% taking 6 or 7% of all income. Inequality statistics for the 1% are really nice and easy to understand. If the 1% takes 6% of all income, they have 6 times the average income. That's what was the case when I was a child in this country. That's higher. And Sweden, there's lots written about the right-wing government in Sweden increasing inequality. But this would be nirvana for us, if it were to happen. There's China falling at the top, and that shows you how old our data is for India. But it also shows China and India have been following the global trends in the best of taking a bigger and bigger slice of a growing pie. GDP has been going up in these countries, but for some reason the best of 1% have felt the need to take more and more of a growing pie, until recently in China, and that's the data just fixed. Germany, the best way to become a more equal country is to lose a war. That is the most definitive way to do it, because when you lose a war, the invading force gets rid of your elite, at least gets the money off your elite, and doesn't allow your elite to have positions of power so they can corruptly get more money, and like the elite in a country which wins a war. So Germany, which became dramatically unequal in the 30s, I think they blamed it on immigration, so it's terrible, must vote to leave Europe or something. But Germany became, and then they decided to blame the small ethnic group who was 1% of the population. Germany became dramatically unequal, and then becomes more equal, and then this is the current complaint in Germany. But again, you're looking at nothing like the United Kingdom, about 12%, and that's the rise in Japan. Again, maybe calling off. Here's all the countries that there was no data for 6 years ago, and don't worry, I'm not going to go for all of these. But again, just to show you, South Africa coming down this. We were dramatically more unequal in the past, so there's no reason that we should be at the tipping point now, but we may be at the tipping point. And there's certainly vast differences in experiences in what happens. And I will not go through those. I'll just have a look at how many of the highest figures were 2006, 2007, and how there are far fewer the maxima since then. Could be the 1% using the companies that are in the Panama Papers much more. But even if they're 1% are hiding their money more, it at least shows a change in that they're worried about it. They know that that period where we just said, if they get richer, we all get richer, has ended. We don't believe that anymore. Okay, too early to say. I'm going to give you one last piece of evidence, and then I'll talk about Oxfordshire. A tipping point never feels like a tipping point. Go on.
How much of this data, so especially that last slide, you haven't talked much about the global financial crisis and how that's impacted this data. Are you seeing that in any of these data?
It has to be connected. The timing is too close. So there's an argument that says the global financial crisis was partly caused by greed. That gets a point. When the 1% are taking so much and trying to find a new way to get richer, that's when you begin to trade in derivatives that can't fail and you come up with some new skill. The scope to make money out of other people when economies are falling, I think has been lower. But originally, after the crisis, we saw the 1% taking more. It's different to 1929 because inequality was actually falling before 1929, but 1929 helped us accelerate it. Back in 1929, 1920s, nobody thought that things were getting better. But there actually were big rises in inequality then, and in the 30s. when you're very unequal and at a tipping point, it doesn't feel like a tipping point for 20 or 30 years later, but you're still living with incredible inequality. This is my last piece of evidence. It's a May 17th news report. It was reported in The Guardian and reported in The States by Reuters. And the headline, and The Guardian did the same headline, and nobody's done any differently, is CEO, Chief Executive Officer to Worker Pay Gap Stays Wide Despite Wage Hikes. And I think The Guardian headline was Gap Still Too High. And these are exactly the right headlines you want if you're going to get the gap down. But this is what the statistics showed. The best of 500 companies in the United States, the CEO last year made 335 times the average worker. The year before, they had made 373 times the average worker. The average CEO pay fell from 13.5 million to 12.4 million in 1 year. That hasn't happened since I was born. You know, it makes me happy. But I'm quite glad that people aren't out there celebrating, because you need quite a lot more of that to actually get down. I mean, nobody needs 12.4 million. The average worker's pay rose by $900 a year, which is actually quite a lot, because if you take the CEO's pay down by 1.1 million and divide it by 900, that doesn't actually give you enough money to pay all those workers $900 a year. So it wasn't just the CEO pay that's come down in the States, it's the pay of other very highly paid people, quite recently. The Reuters article continues, saying that back in the 1980s, CEOs made 42 times more than the average, and in the 1990s it's 107. So we've got a long way to go to get back to those wonderful days of 1990 and 1980, you know, which were not necessarily that great. And of course, the usual suspects, Clinton, Sanders, and even Donald Trump says how terrible these inequalities were. And of course, in Britain, Nigel Farage likes attacking inequalities as well. And I think I've got a quote from somebody, here we go, James Copeland, senior fellow at the free market think tank, the Manhattan Institute, called the study useless because it compares two different labour markets. It's like comparing racehorses to gerbils, because these aren't the same animals. When your country gets really unequal, you stop seeing people as being human. This is what happened in Britain in the Downton Abbey times. The maid servant wasn't human. And you can argue it's kind of happened again now in Britain. So we treat each other in this country differently. We spend a lot of time trying to get our children into a school which is not like the school that other people's children go to, unless you're in the bottom 15% in Oxford. From 2017, the US Securities and Exchange Commission is going to require all public companies to actually say what their ratio is. The Audit Commission in Britain already does this. All government departments say what their ratio is. Only one government department has done it twice, that's the Treasury, and inequality within the Treasury has fallen. The average civil servant in the Treasury compared to the top has fallen. That to me, thank you for your patience, I'm going to show you something more relevant. This to me all matters. George Osborne setting a national minimum wage, admittedly for 2020, which I think will be paying a quarter of the population, which is almost Stalinist, if you think about a government doing that. That is quite remarkable.
National living wage.
National, yeah, he's calling it there. There are two living wages, but that'll be his. And it'll be set, he promises, but I don't think there's it, as 60% of median income. If he does that, there will be no in-work poverty, because the EU definition of in-work poverty is you are less than 60% of median income. The government are abolishing, or trying to abolish, the measures of poverty. What they didn't realise is that the European survey actually allows you to carry on measuring poverty in Britain whether they abolish it or not, unless we vote to leave, in which case you can completely impoverish the population and nobody can measure it. Big jump. Something more left. That's all national, that's all about arguing, that's about reading books by Branko Milanovic and Robert Frank. And I honestly think it's very worthwhile. I think what's going on nationally is a change in the moral sentiment. which was what was described in the 1930s as having occurred. But you can't just do things nationally, you do need to worry about where you live. There is living wage campaigns in Oxford. The City Council now pays a living wage which is higher than the national living wage set by the University of Loughborough. It's slightly less than the London living wage. It's about £8.70 an hour, somebody may know. And apparently won't take any tender from any private firm who wants to work for the City Council if they don't pay it too. The University now pays the living wage, but not the Oxford living wage, the slightly lower one, just so we can be slightly behind the times as always. Almost all colleges now pay the living wage. I don't think the hospitals yet do. And there's that kind of action going on. But what other things can you do? Now this is a very strange suggestion, but I just thought I'd give you a slight relief from all those graphs. As Mim said, I grew up in this city, and I left this city in 1986 when I was 18. When I was 18, there were still cars in Cornmarket, but the cars had just gone and there were buses. And it was the middle of bus wars, because Margaret Thatcher wanted buses to compete with each other. So there were so many bus companies that Cornmarket actually stopped working. And I come back and I find Cornmarket's being pedestrianised. Well, that's great. How did they manage to do that? And I come back and I find that they've painted cycle lanes on pavements. And I come back and find they brought in 20 miles an hour in most of the city. And Oxford does change. But the only way you can see it change is to go away and come back 30 years later, because it changes fairly slowly. This is a suggestion about how it might change in the future. I'm not going to talk too much about the middle of the city, other than to say, of course, more of it should be pedestrianised, of course, cheap pedestrianised. This road down here really should be made a bit safer. We shouldn't have people walking on either side in tiny pavements and so much space in the middle of the road. But if you really want to alter Oxford, then take these seven main arterial roads and do something new with them. The county has a plan for cycling in Oxfordshire. The plan commits it to finding six cycle superhighways, I think within 2 years. As far as I know, they failed to find any, and they're not particularly super. But this is my suggestion. These roads become superhighways. This doesn't involve much money, because whatever we do in the immediate future cannot be done with very much money, because there really isn't very much money. You take the London Road, which is the road I cycled along for 12 years to get to school, and you say to the cars and the buses and vans, they can only go one way on London Road, they can only go out to London, because it's called London Road. It's really easy. You know which way it's going to go to London. And that gives you enough space to be a little bit like Copenhagen. The nice thing about living in this country is you can always find somewhere else which has done your clever idea beforehand, because we are a bit behind. And you put two cycle lanes on one side of the road, and two cycle lanes going the other way on the other side of the road, and you even let somebody drive an electronic buggy down if they want to, so they don't have to drive their buggies on the pavement. And you can have many more bikes, because Oxford is a city made for bikes. And the cars just go out. So if you want to drive a car there, you're going to have to drive yourself in a big loop to get round, which might encourage you to get on your bike. In the Netherlands, 50% of commuters walk or cycle to work. You do the same down on the Abingdon and Nifty Road, but going in different directions. You do the same on the Botley Road, and you do the obvious one, which of course will happen first, because they're richer, so it'll happen to the Boundary and Woodstock first. That's where your traffic calming happens first, that's where your 20 miles an hour happens first. And you reduce the amount of traffic in the city. Now this isn't just what they do in Copenhagen, it's actually what they do in Sheffield. And I've spent the last 10 years before I came back here living in Sheffield. In Sheffield, if you drive into the city for the ring road, almost no matter what you do, you have to drive back out the way you came, because they designed the roads and made a one-way system in the middle to discourage people from driving in unless they really want to. County Road, you really need to cut it off so that it isn't worth your while driving in or out on the county road. You still need to be able to get everywhere by car or van, but you don't want people using that mode as a major commuting way in. The easy way to know why is simply to go and stand there at 5:30 in the evening. It's not really isn't rocket science. If you do that, I've only got five more minutes, so don't worry. If you do that, it's easy for people who want to cycle but afraid to cycle to cycle for small space. It's easier for lazy people like me who think, oh, I'll just get in the car, to think, actually, I won't get in the car. And so you make the environment more pleasant. You also, of course, reduce the pollution that's going on in the city. You improve the air quality in the city. But more than that, you provide enough space in the middle of the city to build more houses around the edge of the city. Because at the moment, you can't build many more houses around the edge of the city, forgetting the fact that the colleges own the land and we've made it into a greenbelt. That's a minor problem. The major problem with building more houses around the edge of the city is you get car gridlock. So you have to have more people cycling and walking, and occasionally using buses, but we're almost at bus saturation. Why would you want to build more houses around the edge of the city? Because 40,000 people are commuting over the Greenbelt every day to go to the park and rides to get it to work. They may be commuting because they really, really like driving their car every day across the Greenbelt and they're getting in the bus and going to work, or some of them might actually want to live in along the edge of Oxford. But you can't build the housing unless you change the transport infrastructure. I can go on for other reasons for this. I mean, two others are tourism. We're going to get a lot more of it, and tourists are going to need space. I walked into Lincoln College just now, beautiful and empty. What are we doing in having a college with quads and a chapel and not getting the tourists in and getting a little bit of money off them so we don't have to go begging to Russians with dodgy records for cash? But there will be more tourists whether you like it or not, because tourism is rising in the world. The other reason, which you can ask questions about, is the schools in Oxford. And the problem is the schools in Oxford are segregated. And the housing market in Oxford reflects the schools. And you can't ask a child from one area to go to another very easily by bike, because you go across these and it's dangerous, even at 10 miles an hour. And make Oxford a much more cycle-friendly city, and the school children could mix around a bit more, could go and do an A-level class in another school, and so on, and the parents wouldn't worry about the fact that they were using a bike to get there. You might even get the students to cross out across the river. I think that's a bit much. Last map. If you really want to do a superhighway, this is 30 years away, but it's fun, and it's relatively cheap. What are we doing living in the city with the highest proportion of bikes in the country apart from Cambridge, where almost nobody, apart from slightly suicidal middle-aged men in Lycra, cycles out of the city? How did that happen? And again, this is simply from having spent 10 years living in Sheffield, where we have cycle routes across the Peak District. Thankfully, because there used to be train lines, so they're lovely and flat. So where would you put cycle routes? Don't put them next to roads, because it's not very nice cycling next to a road. You put them, that has a slight problem, but I've always been vindictive to Boars Hill. The reason I'm vindictive to Boars Hill is I come back and decide to walk on the footpaths I walk as a child and find that selfish people have built 8-foot high fences either side of the footpath. Right, it's about the most healthy social thing I've seen in Britain. So I think they deserve a cycle path going through. You build what they do out of Copenhagen and other cities, all Freiburg. Why isn't this city planning to become the Freiburg of England? Why not? Why not become the greenest city in England? If you claim more green and aim for a higher population, do you think people might want to come here? I don't know, to study, say? They might just want to do that. But if you have more people, what are they going to do? What are they going to do at weekends? And this allows you to actually get somewhere at the weekend. You do need to do the right to roam, which somehow Oxfordshire forgot to do, so you can actually go out. And if you are particularly fit and young, you could actually live here and commute in, rather than sitting on the bus for an hour. People already do long cycle commutes, it's just very, very dangerous. But the main reason for suggesting these isn't for commuting, it's actually to get out and see the county. There are 2,000 lakes in the county.
They're almost all private. But believe me, if you go swimming in them, nobody's going to shoot you. They just get slightly upset. They come out and say, can I help you? And the correct answer, then there's some Teresa Hayter, I have to say. The correct answer to kind of help you is, no, I'm absolutely fine. Because you swim in the middle of a lake. But you need an eco-way to get to the lake. Where's the money going to come from? Let's end up with what you've given your money for. We can, of course, spend more. We have one of the lowest spending countries in Europe. The austerity is extreme. There's no need for us to tax so lowly and spend so little. But we are not going to be as rich as we used to be, because we were partly rich because we were had a legacy of an empire, and our banks were not necessarily doing the most reputable work to make us rich. So we're going to have to make some cuts. My favourite suggestion for a cut, apart from Trident, is this Border Force vessel. This Border Force vessel is currently docked in Mytilene off Lesbos. Do you want to know who they're protecting us from? Show you him. He's called Mohammed. He's in the Moira camp, which is now the Moira concentration camp on Lesbos, and it's being deported back to Turkey with the assistance of that ship that we are funding to send this little boy back, because he's a threat to our national security. There are lots of things we can cut and reduce, and we do not have to do. And all that will happen is his family will then try and come in through Libya, will then try and come in through another way. Sending battleships to Lesbos really, really, really doesn't work. Hopefully I've got somebody irate at this point. Things really do change. I get upset when people say it's all so hard, it's going to get worse, it can't get better. I see lots of very, very good changes going on in the world. I worry about the things that are getting worse. I spent this afternoon looking at death rate data showing we had an increase in 30,000 elderly people die last year. The worst increase at any point since the war, as far as I can see. This is the world shaped by population. But that's because I'm looking for the bad news stories, because you need to look for the bad news stories. But we don't look for the good news stories. We don't actually see that people have changed a lot of their behaviour. We've passed peak consumption in a whole series of things. Peak baby, it's slightly dodgy, but it's still looking like peak baby probably was 1990. The last 5 years in the world have seen the most unbelievable fertility drops, almost everywhere, a bit in the aftermath of a global economic crash. But we're now looking as if we're much nearer to 9 billion people than 10 billion people. That's just the last 5 years' data suggests that that's a possibility. There are lots of reasons to be optimistic, but you also need to argue for change and say it's possible, because nobody's going to build cycle tracks out into the coast like Oxfordshire if people in Oxford don't begin to think that actually could happen. Why can't I have that? A very long time ago, somebody built the Marston Ferry Road and built a cycle track next to it, and that was visionary. And when somebody built the Ring Road, they built a cycle track next to it. It's now the most disgusting place to cycle because the Ring Road has become a traffic jam, which it used to be. All these things were done in the past, and they all were achieved. I think it could be achieved again. I think you have to worry about the global picture of the difference between countries, but also say what one thing could be done here, and what's stopping it being done, and who says that isn't possible, and will it really wreck the lives of people who live in the county if a few more people from the city at weekends actually go out and don't drive out by car, and don't decide to take a holiday from Birmingham Airport on a plane, but decide that they actually might want to see for the first time ever the county that they live in, which at the moment we cannot do. It's far too long. Thank you very much. Please ask me some more questions. Thank you. And if anybody wants to go and grab a drink, don't feel you're being rude, go and get a drink from downstairs or something. It is very hot. In the back.
Can I say a bit more about Memphis, which we
Oh,
for the sake of everyone else, apart from Bill Gates, so that we can guess it.
Yeah.
the benefits of the rich of not being so rich in future. Very, very rich people, like Bill, work out that their children are in dire straits if they don't get rid of a lot of their money. Because their children are not like them. Very rich people are often very unusual, very driven. They're not lazy. And their drive helped make them more rich. Now, Bill Gates had an advantage. His dad was rich. His dad sent him to the only private school in America which had a time-served computer. So no other child could have had that advantage on computing. And Bill was driven. But your children are the random products of two sets of genes. And you do not, the drive doesn't pass down. If you look at the wealthiest families from 100 years ago, and then try to find where is generation 5 and 6, and at what age did they die, and how much cocaine was involved, and how much of a failure did they feel, the rich know this as the legacy of rich families. They have family trusts and family offices. And this is if you've got more than 30 million of wealth. That's property rich. 2.5 million is enough for comfort. If you've got more than 30 million, you have a family office, and the family office will promise to protect the children and invest the money wisely and drip feed it to them so that they don't become like the Marquis of Salisbury or wherever, that bloke down in Bath. But it's dangerous. It's dangerous having a lot of money. You also end up living positive lives. So you grow up in a gated estate in London. You're sent to a gated school. You come to a university full of gates and porters. You go off to your job in London with security guards on the door. We never used to have so many thousand security guards on the doors and offices in London. You're living in a prison. You can go on about it abstractly. The studies we need are studies that show that the rich in Scandinavia live longer, better lives than the rich in the USA. There's lots of anecdotal evidence. Lots of people have followed the Kennedy family and other families and looked at pop stars who die far earlier in the United States than pop stars in Sweden die. They're having a reunion, aren't they? ABBA reforming again? The really valuable work to do is work on the benefits of the very rich, of fitting in. The very rich in Japan, the people who go to the school twinned with Eton in the middle of Tokyo, where the children of the royal family go, have an accent that is indistinguishable from other Japanese accents. I only learnt this because I had an interpreter who went to this school. And I said when I found out what school she went to, I said, how's this going to work? If you're interpreting for me and you went to school for the Beaton, aren't people going to think you sound a bit funny when you talk? And she said, no, they just look down on me because I'm a young female. And she was right. No attention at all. But Japan's so different. There are fewer people with an income of over €1 million a year in Japan than in that Barclays Bank Tower in London. It's a very, very different society.
Why do you think that is never articulated politically? How can you get from an academic discussion like this to a sensible discussion politically to say, well, it's not really been harm anybody if you did a little bit of my tax? It's quite difficult for people sometimes to actually place themselves politically. For a lot of people in some things which might be considered left wing,
yeah.
Some people and other things are sort of right wing, but you get categorised if you take any particular point. Yeah. Why don't you think people could make a sensible discussion come out of the window? A lot of people know that, but why do you think anybody could make a sensible argument
about it? That actually comes from Owen Jones's book, The Establishment. Some of our people have tried, and Owen's a journalist. The politics are unequal countries, all political parties move to the right. So the Labour Party, until a couple of years ago, was, in terms of the policies it was enacting, to the right of policies Margaret Thatcher would have agreed with in 1981-82. And certainly not offering to bring the tax rate down to the rate she had. So the politics of a whole country changes. and you think you're left or right wing in Britain, but actually you're right wing compared to most people. Or Merkel, who we describe as right wing, who has allowed in 1 million Syrians and doesn't break up the boards of control in Germany where trade union leaders are actually on boards of companies and so on. We're a very odd country. Every other rich country in the world has a token rich person who talks loudly about how bad it is that the rich have so much. I've forgotten the name of one, he's called Nick somebody, he's a billionaire in the States. Say it again,
Hanauer.
Who talks about how the pitchforks are coming and this makes no sense and he doesn't deserve the riches. All countries in Europe have people. The Netherlands had a boss of all Dutch Shell over a decade ago, saying if you pay me half as much as what I've worked just as hard. We don't yet have our single rich person. So maybe Russell Brand, because he was quite rich. So that's part of the difficulty. But we also try to suppress the information. So we have well over 2,400 bankers getting over €1 million a year in pay. The next highest number is in Germany, it's less than 200. In the rest of Europe, the number of bankers getting over €1 million has dropped in the last year, which is data, and it's tiny. In Britain, it's increased, and it's not just the pound, very good strength. David Cameron and Osborne both tried to stop the European Central Bank collecting or releasing that data. So there's a deliberate attempt for this not to be the debate. There's a deliberate attempt to get us to talk about other things. So the reason we have problems isn't because we fund our school system so strangely, only Chile's more unequal in terms of education. It's because of all the immigrants coming to our schools. And the reason we have a housing problem isn't that we have one of the worst housing systems in Europe, the smallest and most expensive houses. It's because the immigrants have come and used up our houses. And why do you talk about the immigrants if you don't actually believe the immigrants are a problem? You talk about the immigrants because it stops people talking about the real reason why schools in England are not good compared to schools in France and Germany. And why housing quality is low and house prices are high. We have incredible unequal use of our housing. We've got more empty rooms now than we've ever had. We haven't built many, but we've built more rooms, and more rooms are empty every year in Britain. Because elderly people with some money are sitting in the house because it's rising as an asset, and it's in the interest of their grandchildren if they stay in the house and pass it on. And that only works if it's rising as an asset. As soon as house prices begin to fall, if you're sitting in a £3 million six-bed house on the Woodstock Road, and house prices begin to fall, and you think they're going to carry on falling, the faster you sell that house and get out, and somebody with more than one person moves in, the better use of our housing will have.
That's not the only reason why people stay housing in those situations, that it's hard for people who are elderly to move out as
yes. Well, this is one, the housing I think we should build around Oxford. I've specially reserved in my little fantasy world, Hinksey Heights Golf Course, for apartments for elderly people, with beautiful views. You know, the views Matthew Arnold wrote about, the dreaming spires. You know, nobody can see them. The trees have grown up on Boars Hill, so you can't actually see them from there. Apartments with lifts, no stairs. So you can decamp from your large house to your three-bed or four-bed house in Oxford. Get a lovely view, make a little bit of money, and then scooter down half a mile and come to the talks we arrange in the university for dignitaries. Where it's really embarrassing if we don't have a full audience. And we're arranging 20 talks every night across university. We can't expect the undergraduates to keep on coming. So we need an audience. And if the university gets bigger and more successful, we're going to need an even bigger audience. US campuses do this. They have alumni housing for elderly retirees to go back and feel, you know, what was it like when you were 18?
Students help them move then.
They help them move, yeah, to that. Oxford needs housing very nearby because people have got their friends. There will almost certainly be somebody from the Green Party here. The Green Party's position, as far as I could see at the last election for Oxford, was that if you want to downsize or get another house, you should move to Newcastle because that's where their house is. It doesn't work with friendship networks. It really doesn't. And it's not green. What's green is stopping people using cars. And one of the best ways to stop them use cars, apart from more light rail and five trains an hour or more from Didcot, or possibly 12 trains an hour from Didcot, is to actually let people live near to where they want to be during the day. And Oxford was artificially constrained in the 1930s by the university because the university was scared of the car factory. The car factory now only employs 3,000 people and is more high tech than the university.
Thank you, Richard. Can I make a comment and then ask questions? Yes. So on some of your earlier slides, you're looking at the footprints. I do have a water background, so I just want to say something that might connect some of those perhaps together. It's about Denmark. So Denmark, it does have a large pig industry, but because of that, it has a very bad water quality problem. So a lot of nitrate pollution of water. And I thought maybe it might help explain the meat consumption slide you have, and also maybe the ecological footprint slides. I'm not quite sure what goes into that. But the water quality issues and the detrimental impacts on ecology because of the intensive pig production, I thought might help you connect the dots on
that. Thank you.
But my question is, you're very inspiring and hopeful that things might change, and it does seem like things are changing, but Is it just kind of like a short-term bubble? So in the media, whenever there are floods, there's a great tension on floods, and oh yes, we must do something. And then when it slipped away in the mind, when other things have happened, you know, go back to normal.
Yes.
And given all the arguments about Brexit, which leave or remain, and all kind of all the victimization and the tension, as you mentioned, and the previous speakers mentioned, the shifting of attention away from possibly discussing things like this, onto vulnerable members of society.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, could it just be, and it could be. You had in last year, President Obama said inequality was the biggest problem after climate change. President of China, the Pope, Christine Lagarde. I mean, inequality's never had a better year than last year. Davos, the year before, put it in the top three problems. These are, you know, the greediest people in the world saying that inequality's the problem. It's possible. I suppose you could have a similar issue about nuclear weapons and nuclear war, which is something we've kind of forgotten about even though the missiles are still there. But we are much further than midnight than we were with nuclear war. What makes me optimistic is that when it tips, there's often a process that keeps it on tipping, because as soon as it becomes acceptable to say, are you being paid too much? The answer will carry on being yes for 20 or 30 years. The only way people pay to get this high was that it became unacceptable to question the pay. You know, you are, and it's a change. As soon as you begin to say, do you really need that, you go a lot lower than 12.5 million, if the moral sentiment keeps going. But the kind of thing you need to do, if you want to keep it going, you really need to galvanise young people. The best way to galvanise young people is to send them to war. Even better is to send them to another war, where the first war was told you that there would be another war. That made the generation who came back after 45 really angry. We, thankfully, are not sending our young people to war, but we are, for 50% of the population, certainly 50% of the women who go to university, we have decided that we're going to give them a debt that's larger than their parents have ever had. And then we're going to start giving them statements that they'll get annually or if they look at monthly, telling them how much money they owe us because they went to a university. If that's not going to make people angry about inequality. And this is the middle class. The middle class of Britain, your average repayment is 56,000 if you get an average job. If you get a slightly good job, it's over 100,000. Unless Mum and Dad actually quietly paid the 9,000. Imagine how you'd feel when you find out that one of your friends has no debt because their mum and dad are a bit richer than yours. Are you going to go, oh, it was my fault for not trying hard enough to get better parents? And this has only just happened. We've only got 3 years worth of students. The first lot have come out. The number of stories in the papers last week from students threatening to sue because they were advised badly as children to take out a debt for a university education that would guarantee them a high income. You know, that's going to keep this going unless we manage to get the middle class youth of the country to blame themselves. Or blame the immigrants for our... Am I waiting for that one to happen? The only reason that university numbers went up last year is immigration. We had a big increase of students from the rest of the EU coming to England. Without that, we've had a fall. And as soon as you've got a fall, you've got to start sacking members of staff. In fact, for universities, there's a financial problem this year because 3 years at £9,000 means that next year we get the same income, they're still paying £9,000. We do have a little bit of inflation. We can't increase fees. Our income is dropping. But thankfully, all these young people from France mainly and a bit from Romania have come. So why are they coming when they cost £9,000? Partly with very good marketing. In a normal country, you don't market university. Here we have 30 that say they're the best 10 in the country. But also, don't tell Nigel this. We haven't got long to go, 23rd. If you're a child in the EU, you are eligible for a loan from a student's loan company. So you can come here from France and study at Oxford, and then when you go back to Paris, you're supposed to write a letter telling them where you are. And of course, when you go back to Romania, even if you get a good job, on incomes in Romania, you'll never get to the threshold to have to pay it back. So the big increase from Eastern Europe going to universities. This is good because we're getting some really clever young people who've managed to work this out.
They're
better than maths. the entire student loan system is not going to work. We already have it agreed publicly that 50% won't be funded and repaid. But it's much worse than that. But did you arrive at the Sunday budget the last 3 years? Have you paid £9,000 fees?
In Wales, it's
£4,000.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And we can make £4,000 a little cheaper compared to £9,000. It's just expensive compared to €400 in Germany. And that's pretty bus pass.
Do you not think a massive part of it is the sort of like not our fault attitude in a sense? Because if you look at Scandinavian countries compared to the UK, it's as if nobody likes to take responsibility for the problems. So even whenever you mention stuff about the richest part of Oxford would get the 20 miles per hour a bit fastest, and everyone laughed. Yeah. And actually, part of it is the fact that sometimes if we were able to tell, like someone said earlier, tell the wealthier people what benefits they have, that was something in the spirit level that surprised me so much, was actually, especially health inequalities, quite affects everyone in the whole population. Yeah. And actually, I sort of think, if it became a priority to tell everyone the positive things rather than always about things getting worse, do you not think that would have more benefit to making young people today take responsibility for changing that?
I think young people today need to notice they're quite capable of changing things. Because I would like young people to begin changing things before I'm in my 80s, I've got a catheter in me, and they really take revenge. I mean, that's my worry. I'm part of this generation. I get paid out of these £9,000 fees. So part of my reason to want to see change happen earlier is I'm worried about the retribution that will come and the complete lack of sympathy for my generation and people older than me. If we become more right-wing, then what happens to the elderly gets worse. We already have falling life expectancy in two districts in Oxfordshire for elderly women, which are over 85, which shows what's possible.
I think it's one of the things, like, in Northern Ireland, they've got the highest GCSE maths and English results in the UK, and Northern Ireland there's one private school, it's a tiny small private school, and that sort of, nobody actually knows that, and sort of promoting things, explaining to people the benefits, do you think that there's,
trying to explain, Sheffield used to send more children to university than Bristol. Right, Sheffield's a big poor town, Bristol's a rich town. Why? Because Sheffield only has one girls' private school, it's only good and it's tiny, and Bristol, like Oxford, is full of private schools. and the aggregate effect of private schooling might be to increase space, then it's going to private schools to increase space, everybody else even more. So look, the problem is we're stuck with our sentiments at the moment. We're stuck with what we're used to, and we've learned a certain degree of callousness, so we don't care as much as people in more equal countries care. I tell this story too often, but the first time I was ever in Oslo, I made a huge mistake. I was in a room like this, except there were three people with babies. That's the difference. You come to talks and you bring your baby. This is a very quiet baby here. And I opened my talk by saying, congratulations on having the lowest rate of child poverty on the planet. And two people shouted out, it's too high, how can you say that? We should be congratulated. Despite the fact that it was the lowest. They were angry about the rate of child poverty in Oslo and Norway. In the United States, when I was talking to PhD students, this is 20 years ago now, and I was talking about poverty, a PhD student studying social science who'd been homeless and lived in a tent told me she dragged herself up from her bootstraps and everybody else should do the same. Why should you care about people who are poor? They just need to try harder. And that was not her fault, it's because she'd grown up in the United States. And it isn't that they're saints in Norway, it's that they've grown up in an environment where you genuinely care more about other people and see them like yourself. But take the difference between Japan and the States. When you get the water flooding in from Hurricane Katrina to Japan, to the United States, New Orleans, you send in the National Guard and you think about shooting people. And you don't get them out of the ninth quarter. When the tsunami hit in Japan, I was in Japan, nobody sends in the National Guard. I was with a group of students in Kyoto who were collecting buttermilk cream to send because people on the coast had everything else they could possibly need. And it took the students at the university some time to work out this is the one thing that nobody sent. And I went to the census offices in Tokyo where they had these giant warehouses they constructed to count the census forms in Japan. And they were taking them down slightly early and putting them on lorries and sending them up to the coast for people to sleep in. And I said to the head of the census in Tokyo, that's great, so the government organised this. He said, no, we just decided to do it because they're like us. And I've grown up in this country where it's a shock where people help each other. In Sheffield where I work, there were floods. And the Vice-Chancellor Keith, luckily at that term, the Vice-Chancellor opened up the halls of residence for people who've been flooded to come in and for free be in the halls of residence. Can you imagine? And Oxford, of course, can flood. Can you imagine it happening here? If you remember the rally for the refugees, was it a year ago? It's about 2,000 people, I think. It's only supposed to be 200. And I remember somebody shouting, do you want to help a refugee, and never put their hands up. And then somebody shouted, have you got a room for a refugee, and never put their hands down. You're in Oxford, you have any spare room. And I kept quiet, but I couldn't help thinking, you put all these quads, you know, you could put a tent on there, but that's only slightly the real place. If Cameron was like Merkel, where would the refugees go? They're under flyovers in Germany. Which town in Britain there's such a tight green belt that it's got a huge area of fields around it, only 2 miles from the centre, where you could put a tent city of refugees if you needed to. East and west, Shotova and Hinksey Heights again. I'm digging in the gardens in Balls Hill. I'm going to stop my particular. East and west, and then what happens are Oxford plans are to develop north and south along the floodplain, because east and west is somehow sacrosanct. Near the city centre. Oh no, don't go there because somebody wrote a poem there about being inspired. Not about the value of poverty. Should we do one more question?
I have a question, well, a kind of reflection, but also a question. You were mentioning in one of your slides about some of the impacts of inequality and about trusting each other less, and I guess the question would be, you know, what role does fear play in that, and how does fear drive inequality as well? And I just, and a sort of reflection from experience in Oxford campaigning against the public space protection order is really seeing how fear of poor people can allow rules to now make it illegal to beg or you know, be poor in Oxford or have a tent and be homeless in Oxford. And it's like, okay, where is fear in that, and what's driving kind of fear of other people in that kind of inequality as well?
Yeah, because Oxford was on the old, it's on the old tramping route, which is why on Square Tramps are there. We are more frightened, but that's because we don't mix as much with each other. That's the problem. And we treat each other differently because of the lack of mixing. I used to have a lovely girlfriend called Anna, and I first went out with Anna when I was 17. And I wanted to show off with Anna, and I was coming down to St Clement's, and there were some students dressed up in their stupid clothes. And I have to admit, slightly shamefully, but not too much, I threatened some of them with violence. They haven't actually done anything, they've just been a bit obnoxious and loud. They were wearing this really stupid, you know, white bow tie, which I now wear. and they ran off, and I frightened them. And I was so chuffed. And Anna said to me, why did you do that? And she wasn't impressed. It didn't help very much with what I was then intending to do next. at all. But then she said to me, that'll just make them nastier people. And I've just got a horrible fear of who it was. Because you can work out now, daughter's too young. Boris and Dave, exactly the right age. But I would never have tried to pick a fight with them. If they hadn't been wearing different clothes and been so different, then that was the reason why I wanted to fight them. My little brother, I should say, maybe no aunt? Okay. My little brother got in worse trouble for beating up students. He had a genuine fight with some students. They were obnoxious and they partly started it. And then they went away and they came back and the fight got worse. Turns out it wasn't the same group. And in court, my little brother said, my little brother's half black, which partly explains why. He said they all look the same to me, about Oxford University students. And back then, you know, there were punk pilots, you'd see for punks and so on, and beat people at the cash points. That's gone. You know, the other things have got better. That kind of violence is gone. But in a normal country like England, if you go to university, you go to the university in your town. You carry on living with your parents, you keep your friends, including those who don't go to university, and your university is part of your city. And that happens in a large amount of Wales, it happens in Ireland, it happens in the whole of France, and to an extent Germany.
Scotland.
So, yeah, in Scotland, certainly been to Glasgow, Edinburgh slightly less. Edinburgh's nice because it's got problems, so Scotland doesn't look perfect. We are just very, very odd. Even in the United States, fees are lower, and if you go in-state, they're even lower. And there's a tradition of going to a local university in-state. We used to have Oxford Polytechnic. Now to A to B, this county doesn't have a university for children in this county anymore. So we've got a long way to go to even become slightly normal. But somebody's got to be weird. You know, there always will be a most unequal country in Europe, and we happen to be it at the moment. So the only way is actually to become less unequal. We are very, very unlikely to become more unequal, because inequality is really expensive, which is part of the reason the UK was so unequal, because we have an empire, and part of the reason the United States was so unequal is because it had a de facto empire. Getting that much money and giving that much money to the rich does require an income from elsewhere. Sustaining really high inequality when your country's getting poorer is very, very hard to do. I'm going to sign books or whatever, if anyone wants to buy a book, I'll do that. If anybody brings me a drink, I'll get you one for free. I'm just coming out with questions, but thank you very much for your patience, and thank you for coming.